You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello and welcome everyone to yet another episode of the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is November 5th of 2025. I'm going to be talking about something today that of course is very important to me and is very critical to what my really career is about. My book on the war in Ukraine will be published fairly soon. I'm at the very, very, very final stages of citations and picking out a cover and stuff like that. So we're talking about a fairly short period of time. It's been a long time in the making. Now, it's always very daunting to do a book on current events. I've really never done it before. Maybe the book, The Islamic World, maybe. Because anything could happen. But I'm pretty sure that what I lay out here is not going to suddenly be made irrelevant somehow. I strongly doubt that. Because even though this event is going on, this is a current event, it is contextualized in theory and history, which is, you know, what I do. It's going to be possibly the only truth-telling book in the entire literature. I have not seen if there are other books on the war yet. I could only assume that they are. I don't want to know about them. God knows what they're saying. It's bad enough having to talk about this war and the destruction of an entire nation, the backbone of orthodoxy in the East, as Ukraine was for a long time. I don't need that nonsense as well. The war in Ukraine, which I've termed the Russo-Ukrainian War of 2022, that makes sense. It has been subject to media lies and disinformation abominably. It almost is like sketch comedy at this point. And it's still going on. There's nothing funny about it. It's a parody of media disinformation. Mass ignorance about the area and about its history means that the ruling class in the West could say whatever they want and be believed. And there are far too few to correct this avalanche of errors. Of course, that's Johnson's Law. This war broke out when I went on my honeymoon, because whenever I, you know, go away or something like that, something major happens. But when I got back, the initial claims were that Russia has been defeated, that Ukraine and the West have proven their superiority. But I knew that such a statement required not just ignorance, but you had to be immersed in a carefully crafted narrative maintained by all media, tightly controlled, using the same buzzwords, phrases, slogans, and ideas repeated over and over again. This media is both Jewish and centralized. The goal wasn't that hard to achieve, given that the government in Kiev is almost entirely Jewish, as was the foreign policy team under the so-called Biden administration. It really was ethnic. You had Jews on both sides. There are only two losers, Russia and Ukraine. So I wrote this book for very obvious reasons. It's a desperately needed corrective to the cavalcade of absurdity that I have to deal with on a daily basis. as I've said before, falsehoods and myths, you know, the way that they get ensconced in a society is that they are used as foundations for later theorizing. And then that theory, in turn, is used to misinterpret future facts and future events. That's how a lie becomes institutionalized. And over time, it's indisputable, especially if you're, you know, your typical university professor who is completely isolated from anything that, any of our work, any work of nationalism, since his world is completely censored and sanitized. And they spread like poison. See, once falsehoods, once mythology becomes a theory, or is used as a foundation of a theory, and then used to interpret future events, the error, the original error, becomes very hard to dislodge. And I'm saying that on all of this, do all liberal systems depend? Now, many of you know, but there's some who do not, I want to reiterate what I mean by the word regime, with a capital R. And I use it in the book over and over again. This is my term, used to describe the nature and source of political power and social power on the global stage, right now symbolized and led by the USA. It is liberal in its ideological, or leftist in its ideological orientation. And since it's an oligarchy, it couldn't be anything else. But political science, as it functions today, doesn't seem to be aware of how power really originates and functions. Sometimes the old terms don't serve to define how the world's powerful function. And of course, they're terrified of being called a conspiracy theorist, so they keep using the old irrelevant. And I have an entire paper, we'll talk about this maybe later, maybe some other time, on the political economy of oligarchy. Old economic assumptions don't work. There are no markets. Oligarchies do not respond to markets, they create them. And you also know I spent a lot of time on the private sector. I'm sorry, things like the private sector, public sector. These terms don't work anymore either. Markets, rational choice, civil society. I spent a lot of time on these terms and language. They suggest a complete misunderstanding, or at least an incomplete understanding, of how power has changed since the 21st century started. Boundaries between and among all of this has long been blurred. A new terminology must be found, but it's not. I'm the only one talking like this. So, when I use the word regime, take it as a synonym for the ruling classes, internationally speaking. More commonly, the global oligarchy, based mostly in the West. See, I use the term regime because the phrase deep state, it only refers to state power, albeit of a very specific type. Governments are only one player in this melange, this melange of power, malice, and deception. Although, of course, it's very important, and every country has one. But the state is only one player. The state is quite dependent, especially the American government that needs banks and other institutions to function. So who comprises the regime? Well, I mean, there are many entities, but a brief list would be the major banks. It's hard to put them, you know, anywhere but first. The BlackRock monopoly, other Wall Street conglomerates too. The media, no question about it, journalists. Your larger corporate-funded non-governmental organizations, the NGOs. Definitely the scientific establishment. The major foundations, which finance most research out there, especially in, you know, mainline academia. Academia itself. The military and military contractors. Your typically integrated multinational corporation, operating over many sectors. Jews as an ethnic group, they are almost the vanguard of the regime. They're overrepresented to almost a comic level within it. The regime self-consciously denies its own existence in public, but they're aware of the power that they have. Just a quick look at the Bilderberg participants gives a solid idea of what I'm talking about. Bohemian Grove. A few people have infiltrated it. I've given the list of its membership. This is what power is. An oligarchy, by definition, acts conspiratorially. The difference between private and public sectors, that is to say, corporations and the state, has been, I would say, almost completely erased. Not completely, it's been erased. See, oligarchy uses government, but it's not a government in and of itself. It exercises power through various fronts, and money always does. The regime is a collection of all of these forms of power. I should have included in the above, you know, the Ivy League, Rockefeller and Ford Foundation, World Zionist Organization, all this stuff. And whatever disagreements that they may have are hashed out at those meetings. Now, the regime, of course, is going to provoke a strong opposition. We call this the axis of resistance. This is international, and this includes Iran, Russia, Burma, Hezbollah, China, many others, including institutions like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. You know, Hezbollah is not a state organization, neither is Hamas. These are the antithesis of liberalism. They're more or less social nationalists. And religious sometimes. They function to war against liberal imperialism. They collectively operate in opposition to the ruling regime that is global in scope. Wars are begun by liberal imperialism at the moment. We all know why. Globalization is essential to the profitability of capitalism. In fact, now globalism is capitalism's main expression. At one time, the Axis used to include Libya, Iraq, sort of, Syria and the Sudan. But what are they now? They're fourth world starvation centers. And they're that way because of the attacks against them from the very regime that they oppose, especially the U.S. The regime today, which is decentralized, and it's not personalized either. It's not a king that you could attack. They standardize official narratives, they overthrow governments, and they set policy in anything affecting global politics. Any oligarchy, any plutocracy is a conspiracy. So what is my role here? Why am I writing this stuff at all? Under these conditions, the job of any serious scholar is to ruthlessly deconstruct these narratives, these stories, these myths. And as a result of this, a group of intellectuals worldwide have come into being, and we are to challenge the regime at the most fundamental levels. I am one of these. Others include Alexander Dugin, Paul Craig Roberts, E. Michael Jones, Ron Unz, Diana Spengola, Michael Hoffman, of course the late Michael Collins Piper, many others. Most of us live fairly normal lives. But intellectually, we function on the fringes of society. Now, this group, of which I'm a member, despite the total lack of any institutionalized support, we have collectively published an impressive amount of material containing all the things that your average university professor is not allowed to talk about. Information, argumentation that you really can't find if you search on Google or you go to the academic library. The regime, especially in the EU, as we all know, has gone to great lengths to ban any mention of this kind of thing. Not to mention our publications. So, this is the intellectual side of the Axis of Resistance. You know, I want to pause here. I cannot believe I am living at a time where you can talk about, you know, Jews and Jewish power, and that this is being done by, you know, mainstream conservatives talking about it after the murder of what's his name, Kirk. I heard Congressman Fine from Florida give a speech. I think it's called the Republican Jewish Coalition or something like that. He's losing his mind. He said, I can't believe it. It's on YouTube. We have been thrown out of 109 countries. Now, I don't know how many times Jewish congressmen even talk about that. And he says, it may happen here, but so long as I'm in Congress, they're not going to win. Words to that effect. There was panic in his voice. He's usually a very calm man. Now, I've cited the craziness of Congressman Fine before on issues like this. But the fact that Israel and the Jews, if you talk about Israel, the Jews are going to be involved one way or the other, have now become mainline in even the Republican Party, of all places, is extraordinary. And a lot of that is because of people like us. All the people that I mentioned. It's a wonderful time to be alive. I that came out of nowhere, but I always remind people, the USSR collapsed pretty much overnight. A year, from 1989, no one thought it was going anywhere. The CIA was talking about its economic growth. A very short time later, it was gone. So you had a massive empire collapse in peacetime? There wasn't any, especially awful economic crisis in the world. There certainly were no sanctions on it. In other words, things can change very, very quickly. Now, the intellectuals that the regime uses, usually in the universities, research institutes, they've become intellectually soft. And they have become this way because they don't really hear fundamental opposition. Maybe unless it's in the form of like late night caricature. In my field, academia is stagnant. And I know why. They must follow a strict official ideology, leftism in one form or another. White male professors, especially young, live in constant fear of being called racist or whatever and seeing their career go down the drain for some comment or something that someone invented. See, I know the arguments of the establishment, academic and otherwise, inside and out, but they don't know mine. Their world, as I say, is censored and sanitized. As a result, sometimes they can't tell the difference between news, entertainment, or propaganda. Because their news is their ideology being read back to them. So they think their ideology is factual. But I'll tell you something else. I can live a full scholarly life outside the university full time because people like you have sought out my work and sometimes even donate money for it. They read and listen because they want to, not because they have to. I am peer-reviewed. My peer review system is open source and far deeper, ongoing, and detailed than the present system. I mean, I have peer-reviewed publications from years ago. People donate money, which is what keeps me solvent as a full-time scholar. A scholar is different from an academic these days. I wonder how many of my former academic colleagues could ever do that, ever pull that off. Their publications are hidden away in journals no one reads. And usually do not expose them to public comment like I do. They know captive audiences. They use their student papers as research. Within the Axis of Resistance, we have to do everything ourselves, creating a very different type of scholar and a very different type of man. Of course, all of this is relevant to the Ukraine war, because nowhere do you have this avalanche of propaganda and lies taken as fact by people who should know better. Censorship in the US and the EU, especially the latter, has reached such preposterous heights. Young university professors have no conception that there's an entire world of information and theory out there that undercuts their most fundamental liberal and globalist assumptions. So over time, they can only think their system is that's a sophisticated point of view. Looking at those, for example, people who voted for Donald Trump, that is, what the white working class as an ignorant group of expendables that they somehow have to do away with. So hopefully, the book that I'm about to publish will cause some cognitive dissonance, or at least ruin someone's day. I do what I please. I'm beholden to no one for over 20 years. I've been at this 35 years now. My work is original, interesting, and both factually and logically correct. And when it's not, I readily admit it and fix it. The truth is all that matters. The regime is not all powerful. Its functionaries in banking, military, international trade, among other places, yeah, they're pompous, they're detached, but they're also very fallible people. See, their wealth separates them from ordinary life. They don't understand the ordinary man, the working man. They don't understand him, nor do they respect him. How can they not eventually come to believe their own illusions? And then eventually base policy on it. Those making policy today, November 2025, generally don't know that much about Russia, Belarus, or Ukraine. But rather, they construct the leadership of these nations in their imagination. It's called constructivism. They've created a dragon that they need to slay. But without any understanding... This is how power operates. Without understanding it, very little in world politics is going to make any sense. Now, a few chapters deal with, you know, technical things like missile systems. I don't pretend to be an expert on this. I've spoken about this before. I rely on others, and I cite them copiously. Drago Bosnich has been one of my main sources for this. He tends to specialize in this kind of thing. So when I'm talking about stuff like that, I'm relying on his expertise and maybe a few others. Now, I want to say something right off the bat. Most of you know, who've been following me for any length of time, I am not, nor have I ever been anti-Ukrainian. I'm not even opposed to Ukrainian independence. I strongly recommend any of you who may think that, read my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, which came out in 2018. That lays out in great detail what my views in the matter are. See, when I converted to Orthodoxy, I came through the Ukrainians. And I have nothing but the fondest memories of my old parish in Lincoln. But that has nothing to do with what rules Ukraine now. Who rules in Ukraine? Really, since 2014 or even 2004. That's not Ukrainian. It's an unreasonably self-assured, mostly Jewish plutocracy that has no connections to a nation that venerates the heroism of Bogdan Khmelnytsky and Ivan Gonta. How can they possibly like Ukrainians? Ukraine never became independent in 1991. It came under the thumb of the West, using this clique in Kiev to maintain order. You know, Russia could be autarkic. Ukraine can't. Independence is always going to be tempered because even the greatest of Ukraine, Khmelnytsky himself needed to find allies, needed to find supporters to buttress his position. There's nothing wrong with it. Ukrainian culture is extraordinary. And to a great extent, I mean, I know there's other authors who say that it's really old Russian culture. And this is where the old believers fled. Ukraine, in my professional and scholarly opinion, should be an independent national state, although without the Russian-speaking areas, because they're Russian. And I say that in the same sense that Belarus is independent today. Belarus is independent, but is part of this Slavic, Eastern, generally Eurasian idea. institutionally and otherwise. You know my model has been the great Hetman Pavlo Skoropadsky, who ruled only briefly in the chaos of 1918, and yet he created an independent and functional state that no one else could and no one else did. What I'm saying is Ukrainian independence can only be real within a Slavic and Eurasian context, and only with an economy aimed at the Eastern markets who actually want Ukrainian products. Ukraine makes nothing or grows nothing that the West wants or needs, that it can't do itself. Ukraine could never be autarkic, of course. And we hear about the European choice. That there's no choice ever made that was imposed on the country. But this European choice started the depopulation of the country back in 1990. Depopulation started back then. Their population fell. But now, we now know, objectively, because of the Russian hackers and everything else that's happened, 2 million of her best men lay dead. Russian hackers broke into the main computers of the Defense Department. They spread that far and wide. It's absolutely genuine. 2 million. It makes sense. I think they may be including mercenaries. I don't know who's included or whatever, but this is Ukrainian paperwork. That's the European choice that they made. The same European choice that has led the world's most educated nation to third world status from the late 1990s to today. And every word I speak, she's becoming even more impoverished. The USSR didn't do that, and Putin didn't do that. The West did that. The foreign elements that rule in Kiev, and they take orders from the U.S. Embassy. You can't talk about Ukrainian politics without talking about that. They're foreign. They take orders from the U.S. Either reading my book or studying any event involved, you have to keep that in mind. By refusing to acknowledge the ethnic reality of the oligarchy in Kiev, that is, that they're Jews, mainstream writers border on the ridiculous. They refuse to acknowledge this, the nature of the ruling class in Kiev, because they're either ignorant or afraid. Today, as we all know, you know, censorship has, it's very possible they simply don't know. Analyzing Ukraine in a scholarly way, without talking about its wealthy Jewish plutocrats, it's like claiming to be an expert on Tibet without knowing that they're Buddhist. This tiny ruling group, this oligarchy, this plutocracy, along with its U.S. and NATO masters, is physically destroying a generation of mostly Ukrainian Orthodox men through this feudal war that they never had a chance of winning, that the West has provoked over and over and over again over years. They've destroyed what was left of this already destitute country, and they left this nation scarred with PTSD for generations into the future. Any historian knows that Ukraine has a glorious history. But what is left can only be saved by a military coup, preferably a Cossack one, that would throw out the EU and NATO and then look to the east. That's their only hope. Otherwise, she's doomed. I hope to God it's not already too late, but I want to be optimistic about the whole thing. You see, the regime, it's not just incorrect. It's not just misguided. It's evil. See, the most horrific aspect of this war, its current policies, the regime's policies from the West are deliberately depopulating this elite society that formed the backbone of Slavic Orthodoxy. I can only imagine the prosperity that Ukraine would enjoy if it remained in the Eastern orbit. But through this obsessive and bizarre hatred of Russia promoted by the U.S. and NATO, Ukraine only has one function: to be used as a weapon, its men as cannon fodder, a spear to slay the imaginary dragon. Ukrainian casualties have been so high, it's become dysgenic. May even count as genocide. since this war, especially over the last 2 years of this war, has been entirely unnecessary. It cannot be won. And the U.S. fights any attempt at peace. I don't know. I thought maybe the Trump administration would do something about it, but I don't know. But that alone shows the regime. It's not just, they're not just misinformed or out of touch. It's demonic. These are the issues that this book will discuss in painful detail. When the best men of a nation are slaughtered, what happens? Those who remain are the future of the country, for better or for worse. People forget that Ukraine was already suffering from substantial population loss since 1993, at least. So this bloodbath makes the disappearance of Ukraine actually possible. Those idiots, and they are idiots, waving Ukrainian flags, demanding war against the Asiatic hordes, they behave like hypnotized parrots. They are completely unaware of what the continuation of this war means, or even how these Ukrainian soldiers are living. Again, the conduct of this war alone proves that the state in Kiev has zero legitimacy at any level. Even without the war, it had no legitimacy. Its structure was imposed by the Americans after the events of early 2014. But even if somehow the current president was legitimately elected, his authority is gone. As many of you know, after May of 2024, Zelensky's powers ran out. The title of this book is Borhi Splachini Krovyu. Debts paid in blood. Now that's a title in reference to really the underlying thesis of this book. That in lieu of any money, functional economy, or assets of any kind, with this land already taken by foreign corporations, what do they have to pay debt with? What do they have to be relevant to the West? All they have left is the blood of their men. They have nothing else of value to give. This is the only interest the regime now has in Ukraine, and its government is depraved enough to actually pay their debt in this way. Going back years ago, my old website, all that kind of thing, I asked the question every time the IMF sent money to Kiev, knowing they'd never see it again. They couldn't even keep track of it. I don't know if I still have those papers or not. And they'd send another tranche. Then they'd send another. Nothing ever improved. Nothing changed. Don't know where this money went, but they kept sending money. Their debt is massive, but I was, why would they do that? I thought they were rational actors, right? Well, if the money isn't there, there are other things. There's land. There's your buildings. There's your industry. Well, what if that's gone? That's gone. Your men are all that's left. There's no women involved. They're all men. The only thing Kiev can offer the Western oligarchy is to act as a battering ram against liberalism's main enemy, Russia, or I should say the Russo-Chinese alliance, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And what's strange to me is that during the Cold War, this kind of rhetoric would be totally unthinkable. This policy would be unthinkable. Let me get something straight. The war on Russia today is not a new Cold War. It's a new Crimean War. It's not a new Cold War because the West never interrupted trade with the USSR and was heavily invested in her economy. The West built the USSR in the 20s and 30s and even beyond. I mean, who else could have done it? The best minds in Russia were either dead, in prison, or in exile. The Crimean War saw almost the entire European continent, except Prussia, notably, declare war on the Russian Empire. It was also the birth of today's Russophobic propaganda, especially from London. It just was absolutely vile. Yet, it is still being used in today's anti-Russian propaganda today. The slaughter of Ukrainian men is a tragedy that is very difficult to consider for very long. The they have destroyed an entire generation. But no one can approach the war, trying to understand it, without understanding the fact that Ukraine... Yeah, I see, I use the word Kyiv because the power only exists in the capital. The revolution of 2014 only existed in Kyiv. I say Kyiv 99% of the time. Sometimes I use Ukraine, but they don't represent anyone but a plutocracy that is urbanized mostly in the capital. Anyway, they do not act independently, nor could they. They are a de facto colony of the U.S. and Europe, mostly of the U.S., as I've said many times before. When this war broke out, I knew what was going to happen. This flurry of instant experts. And I watched them obliviously accept official propaganda as fact without a shred of doubt or self-awareness. It's very hard to stomach. The media's historical, this illiterate myth-making isn't just stupid, but it actually has an effect. It helps justify policies that have led to 2 million Ukrainian men being killed on the battlefield. The regime always relies on the ignorance of its population, as well as its academics, journalists, and public experts to function. But it also relies on mass censorship to control public perception and tightly filter the flow of information. But at least today, I'm happy to say, this edifice, which was rotten at its foundations, is showing signs of strain. I played a little role in that, maybe a tiny little speck of a role in that, and those who support me have played a role. The context of this, I get into far more depth. The context of this, Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022 was a blow to what the world's wealthy termed the Great Reset at their Davos Forum. The Great Reset was proclaimed by the regime during the lockdown experiment of 2020. A lockdown understood even by the ruling class itself as unnecessary and harmful. Thank God I never listened to anybody at the time. But the reset entails a practical but institutional transformation of society from the modern to the postmodern, being the imposition of mass surveillance in defense of a deeply entrenched and self-conscious oligarchy. I said the same thing when I dealt with Zelensky's Big Israel concept, that there's going to be security in every store, in every movie theater. That has nothing to do with the defense of Ukraine. That's the only way he's going to be able to stay in power. Anyway, elsewhere, the COVID-19, the stupid lockdowns, were one of the first steps in this process. The reset was and is touted as the fourth industrial revolution, in which high technology sectors and artificial intelligence push other technologies and labor out of economic relevance, or so they say. Dissent is condescendingly met with claims that this is inevitable. A word that's used only by people who have something to hide. Anytime the passive voice is used, it's a problem. The core of the Great Reset. They talk about a universal basic income, which of course is the support of the ruling powers, and the elimination of consumer debt. The debt would be written off, but at a tremendously high price. You know, during the lockdown, bankruptcy was, not difficult to predict. But in exchange for debt relief, Westerners would be given over their assets. They would give over their assets to the regime's banks. And then, in return, they would get a universal basic income and whatever else they could make elsewhere. The World Economic Forum, one of the regime's essential institutions, claims that workers will soon rent everything rather than own. Of course, they'll use some sense of debt, saving Mother Earth, whatever it might be. The point being to create a dependent mass of proletarian drones without any purpose or any identity. To the point where they believe that without that, their continued global rule is impossible. Hundreds of millions around the world deemed surplus to requirements, as the phrase is, by artificial intelligence are to be robbed of their property in the name of justice. The World Bank Group, the President David Malpass, stated in the fall of 2020 that poor countries will be assisted to return to some semblance of normality after the lockdown. But that would only be conditional on their adoption of neoliberalism and economic austerity, or even more poverty. But of course, since then, everything's got worse. In the West especially, no economic recovery is possible with existing levels of debt. The U.S. is deindustrialized. You have countries all over the world asking for bailouts after the lockdown and loans. But that just means a group of dependent states. The New World Order is now obsolete. If you remember, proclaimed by George Bush I, at the end of the Cold War. But there's something else that comes from the writing off of all this debt. Global banks will then directly dictate economic and fiscal policy to nations around the globe. This is the political economy of oligarchy within a global context or globalized context, which is something specific to the postmodern era. This is a sort of neoliberalism where markets don't apply. Really, they've never applied at elite levels. My paper on this topic, on oligarchy, the political economy of oligarchy, came out in 2023. Rent-seeking and asset-stripping. The political economy of postmodern oligarchy, which is on my Patreon, probably elsewhere. The argument is the existence of oligarchy means that markets don't work or are not relevant. So making reference to them in the economic literature leads to absurd and incorrect conclusions. But there are powers in the way. Chief among them, China and Russia. And as we've discovered, they're more than a match for the weakening West. The reset to function depends on a U.S.-backed war that will weaken their resistance to the regime. We all know the regime's biggest problem is that those who claim to be allied to it are struggling under a massive debt, both public and private. In other words, both households, you know, individuals, companies, and the state. What was Russia's answer? It was the invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. Russia today has long destroyed one of the great reset's clients, the military of Ukraine, built as an invasion force against Russia by the U.S. and NATO. There's really nothing left. Russia has broken through what remains of Ukraine's frontline defenses, of course. The war has long been over. It's just artificially been maintained. But Russia has exposed a country ruled by foreigners, an experimental idea of the Great Reset itself. Even the unreliable New York Times stated that Ukraine has nothing to even slow down the Russian military. The Russian military is growing larger through volunteers from all over the world, especially the Slavic world. Obviously, they have superior training, they have superior leadership, they have superior equipment. Ukraine, tragically, has long run out of capable military men. Really, they're functioning through mercenaries and volunteers from Western militaries, I guess. Their line officers are dead or gone or deserted or POWs or whatever. Now, if you remember, I said the war was over, I don't know, summer of 2022. I meant it. I didn't say the war was ending, but it was absolutely over. It's a relative claim. It's like saying World War II was over at Stalingrad or El Alamein. In other words, at a time where the Axis lost all possibility of victory, if it ever had it, which it didn't. The Ukrainian war was over roughly by the summer, maybe early fall of 2022. The viciousness of this system that has been artificially maintained by the Western powers, by the regime. Under normal circumstances, you think of Georgia in 2008, right? The war would have been ended long ago, meaning that these 2 million deaths since February 2022 have been totally unnecessary. Kiev never had a hope of replacing these guys, or even maintaining a war of attrition for more than a few months. Russia, on the other hand, is extremely cautious. It has tremendous concern for civilian casualties, who in this case were all Russians, many of whom are now or soon will be Russian citizens. So it moves slowly. It reminds me of Franco's strategy in Spain. You know, he didn't move forward until he was absolutely certain he took a city. and all resistance was gone. Then he moved out. NATO stockpiles of weapons, including basic ammunition, are critically depleted. And what's been exposed here is that the manufacturing capacity to replenish these doesn't seem to be responding. The military-industrial complex in the West is outmatched, facing a Russian economy far more stable and productive than anything the West can offer, because Russia is industrialized, the West is not. I mean, the British military, just to use one example, it's the smallest they've been in 400 years. The British could not, for example, what they did in 82 in the Falklands, they could not do that today. They cannot put that together today. They're not strong enough. Germany and France are mostly demilitarized. But the American population, by and large, despite months of ludicrous propaganda, years, doesn't want to fund this war or the war in Israel. And the illegitimate and foreign government in Kiev has reached Boris Yeltsin levels of unpopularity. Ukraine's breakdown is based on Russia's relentless use of precision weapons from the air and, of course, there from land. There's no Ukrainian air defenses. That means Russia just obliterates Ukraine's fortified positions. It explains the collapse of these small but strategic towns like Avdiivka that was fortified over 10 years by NATO. It's also exposed that Russian equipment is superior to NATO's. But even beyond that, manpower, money, leadership, experience, equipment quantity and durability, logistics, morale, everything is superior to the American, the NATO version. This book was difficult to write, I have to tell you. We are forced to watch the depopulation of a country, but not just any country. At one time, the core of Slavic Orthodoxy, it's an act both criminal and demonic. This is a nation that had everything. Education, resources, markets to the east, strong church, tremendous inner strength. I mean, they survived the Soviet Union. A high national IQ, the most fertile land in the world. Outlets to both east and west. They had everything. But rather than prospering as a partner of Russia in the east, she's reached economically the level today of West Africa. Doesn't matter if it's liberalism or Marxism, the result's the same. You see, the fact that the plutocratic elite in Kiev is Jewish is extremely important, because that Talmudic mentality means that they have no problem with mass Ukrainian deaths. And I've said this before. The Ukrainian nation was forged by the Cossacks largely against the Jews and Poles. They were the hammer of the usurers. This war was created by Washington, with NATO as a junior partner. All provocations came from the West. So each grieving family in that country has them to blame and no one else for their unnecessary and innocent suffering. That was back in 2013. A dissident writer, Levko Lyenko, claimed in several articles that roughly between 10 and 15% of the state apparatus in Kiev was made up of actual Ukrainians. They were either, they were from elsewhere, or Jews connected with the Chabad sect. And that connects with many other analyses, including my own. Chabad pretends to be pro-Ukrainian. They're a wealthy Orthodox Jewish group, very closely connected with the oligarchs. They say that they lament the occupation of Ukraine by foreign Vikings, showing that they still see Khazaria as their homeland, because these Vikings were the so-called Vikings, were the destroyers of the first Khazaria, located in Kiev. He's referring to the destruction of the Khazar Empire in 965 by Svyatoslav I of Kiev. Now, I don't believe in the Norman thesis of, I don't believe these were actual Vikings, but that's their mentality. I don't believe in the Norman thesis. I've said that elsewhere. I'm just quoting them. These Vikings were located in Kiev, is what I meant to say, and from there they destroyed the capital of the Khazar Empire in 965. So, once these people took power in the Great Rada, the Great Legislature, they immediately adopted a bill to abolish the Russian language, which they've been imposing. And then later, of course, you could probably say this with me, on the persecution of anti-Semitism, that came into force. Slick, post-Soviet, Maidan, anything like that. Lenin had the same law. And yet, a citizen of Ukraine who receives a passport from Russia faces a fine and a prison sentence between 3 and 10 years. Russia was no threat to Ukraine before 2014. Only a tiny minority of Ukrainians wanted to join NATO, especially if they knew what the bill was. Few Ukrainians hate Moscow, even in the Western regions. Most were quite content working with whomever offered them a better deal, and that was unacceptable to the regime. The regime forced Ukraine to serve it, installing the proper politicians. Now, the rest of the country pays the price, a price that few nations have ever paid. As I've said many times, Ukraine, regardless of their economic situation, produces nothing the West wants or needs. She's an Eastern-oriented economy. Her infrastructure was built mostly by Russia, or in some cases, even the old Soviet Union. So forcing Ukraine into the so-called pro-European course, that began the process of deindustrialization. And it was only stopped by the revolt in 2014 and then the creation of Donetsk and Luhansk, these social nationalist republics. Ukraine's industry was Russian anyway and was located mostly in those areas, Russian-speaking areas. The workers, not the owners who weren't there, in 2014 refused to permit these factories to be liquidated to pay the debts of the plutocrats who already hated them. Russia never made a claim, ever, against any Ukrainian land, even those areas that were entirely Russian. Western governments had to come up with reasons to believe that Moscow was a greater threat than Islam or anything else. So it paid for a revolution in Kiev to pull Ukraine out of into the West orbit, despite Ukraine having none of the prerequisites to join the EU or NATO. I still haven't found a serious set of reasons as to why the regime, you know, the U.S. loathes Moscow. I mean, I know what it really is, but even as far as public propaganda is concerned, I've never come across it to such an extent that they'll slaughter millions to possibly harm it. Most politicians couldn't give a rational answer if they tried. I mean, they're just used to the media monopoly in their favor. It was the same thing with Serbia in the 90s, if you recall. Idiotic journalists talking about Ukrainian NATO membership. They have no clue what they're talking about. They're a Second World military, meaning they're a formerly Soviet military. To join NATO would be ridiculously expensive. See, Kiev's military would have to be completely recreated from the ground up, since all NATO service branches have to use the same equipment, strategy, ideology, and their equipment has to be completely interchangeable with all the other members. Same goes for the EU, really. Kiev's economy will never reach that level needed to join if the criteria were applied seriously. But in practice, we all know countries like Bulgaria have been brought into the EU despite not even being close to the EU standard. But the point wasn't economic. It was to keep Bulgaria and Ukraine away from Russia. I mean, Ukraine's not a member of the EU, but, you know, that's been the claim. You have plenty of politicians who believe they should be. Yeah, at the same time, though, most EU countries couldn't pass the basic criteria for EU membership if they had to reapply somehow. I know I've gone on long enough. I'll let you know when this thing is published. I'm very proud of it. This is a lot of work. I'm proud of myself. You know, a university professor has all these institutional supports. I have you. And that means the world to me. Thank you, everyone. Thank you for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion. Talk Radio for the nationalist community.